Well, good morning, it's Abbey 104. It's just after 11 o'clock. It's time for Folk Tales with me, Terry Bennett. And my guest today is Tim Letherby, who is famous for being the editor of the Western Gazette, Tim, is that right?
Oh, hello, Terry, first of all.
Good morning.
Good morning. I wouldn't say famous, but yes, I am editor of the Western Gazette. That's what people around here would probably know me for, nothing more remarkable than that. But
it's not just the Western Gazette, is it?
No, it isn't. No, so I'm editor of the Western Gazette and the five editions of that, but I'm also editor of the Mid-Somerset series, which is four newspapers slightly further north in Somerset. And I'm also editor of the Frome Standard and the Somerset Guardian, which is going up towards Bath. So if you take all the different editions of those newspapers, yes, it's 11 newspapers in total.
Wow.
So enough to keep me busy.
Yeah, I bet it does. And these all come under the auspices of the Trinity Mirror Group, don't they?
Yes, that's right. It's actually now called Reach PLC. They've had a rebrand, but yes, it's the same company, basically. So yes, they're all part of a region within that national company. I'm in charge of all those ones and make sure we do the news right and cover the right stories in the right way.
We'll talk a lot more about your role as the interview goes on, but just in a nutshell, what does the editor of a newspaper do these days?
Well, the editor has to be a bit of a jack of all trades. It's gone are the days where you could kind of wine and dine people and that sort of thing. I'm basically in charge of the whole production of the newspaper. So everything from making sure the right reporters do the right stories, making sure we don't miss stories, and the overall way in which we cover news, the sort of the ethos that we take, that's all down to myself. And then we take all the production side into things. So I have to make sure that my page designers get the pages out, do the right style of headline, do the right sort of headline, all meeting deadlines. So I'm in charge of the whole process from when the story comes in to when it goes out. I'm not involved myself in designing pages or writing stories, but it's my responsibility to make sure they're done and they all come together in this giant jigsaw that is the newspaper, and it all comes together at the last minute.
And the buck stops with you.
It does, ultimately, yes.
Okay, we're going to do, as we always do on this programme, a bit of a wander through your life and how you came to be where you now are. But you've chosen five tracks for us, as everybody does, and the first one is King for a Day.
Yes, by Green Day. I've always been a huge fan of Green Day, and it was always a lifetime's ambition of mine to go and see them live. I never got the chance. But finally, last year, I did get the chance to go and see them in Hyde Park in London with my wife, and it was probably the best gig I've ever seen. It was absolutely mind-blowing, fantastic. And this is a great fun song, but they managed to make this an 11-minute epic live with 3-minute saxophone solos and all sorts of things. It was utterly brilliant, great fun. And if anyone who's vaguely into rock music or punk music, just try and see Green Day live because they're absolutely fantastic.
We're not going to get the full 11 minutes here.
But no.
We'll have a bit of it anyway. This is King for a Day by Green Day.
Oh,
That was King for a Day by Green Day, as chosen by Tim Letherby, who's my guest on today's Folk Tales. And actually, we should say we're recording it on location in your offices in Yeovil, Tim, aren't we?
We are indeed, yes.
And rather fine offices they are, too.
Yes, yeah. It would have been better to be in Sherborne, but sadly just not possible with a diary, really.
Okay, so you're currently editor of all of these newspapers, but let's go back a bit and talk about your early life. Are you Somerset or are you from further afield?
Yeah, no, I'm Somerset born and bred. I've never actually lived more than 5 miles from where I grew up and never really left here. Yes, I grew up on the Mendip Hills in a village called Binniger. Went to the village primary school there, which is now sadly closed, as so many small, tiny primary schools have done. So yes, I sort of grew up there and lived there till I left home age 24. Then I moved to Shepton Mallet, bought my first house, room, really, as is the case, and then lived there for a while until I met my now wife and we moved into Wales, which is where I currently live.
Let's just go back to early days then. Yeah. Were you one of many or were you only child or what?
No, I got two sisters, one 3 years older, one 3 years younger, so I was the piggy in the middle, really.
Got picked on, did you?
Oh, definitely. They ganged up on me.
What about mum and dad? Were they anything to do with the media industry?
No, not really. My mum was predominantly stay-at-home mum, which was fantastic. You know, we had her around a lot. She went and did work at various doctor surgeries and things like that, and was a nanny and things like that. My dad was kind of involved. He worked for the same company it's all kind of evolved into where we are now, but he ran the transport side of things for the newspaper group. So the local newspaper was the Wales and Shepton Mallet Journal, and he was sort of fleet director and involved in the finance for the transport company who ran all the cars for the reporters and things like that. So while he wasn't involved in journalism, he was ultimately working for the same people, and there was an overlap of when we were both working for the same company, albeit in very, very different sides of the business.
You went to school then in Binniger.
Yeah.
And what was life like in those days? Happy days?
Yeah, wonderfully happy days. It was absolutely lovely. Yeah, the school had 60 children. There was 7 kids in my school year and 4 in the year above. So it was absolutely fantastic. We could just wander down the lane to school. Very, very, very happy days. You had a few sort of good old style teachers. Like I remember one primary school teacher, Miss Hobbs, who as soon as you mentioned you had a wobbly tooth, that was it. She ripped it out, much to many tears and things like that. She was proper old school. You couldn't get away with that But overall, it was an absolutely lovely time. And absolutely.
Very rural setting.
Very rural setting, yeah. I mean, Binniger's got 500 people in it. I said only 60 children at the school. So it's a real shame the school's not there anymore.
And then you had to move on, obviously, at the age of 11-ish, presume. Where was that?
Yeah, then went to Whitstone School in Shepton Mallet, which was the automatic school you kind of fed into. That was obviously, as you can imagine, quite a change for someone from such a rural setting, even though Shepton's not a big place. It was a bit like, bright lights sort of thing, and a bigger school, but even so, it's still not a huge school. Had a really good education there. Met many friends, many of whom I still know now. Our friends have stayed local as well. We play in the same Skittles team together. People I met on my first day at sort of school there. So, it was really, really interesting. And I got into music there and got into playing cricket and things like that. So it was a real growing up experience for the rural boy, really.
Were you academic? Or you've mentioned sport there.
More academic than sporty. I'd like to think I was sporty, but I wasn't really. Wasn't really quite good enough to get. I got into the school football team once, I think. I was quite an academic person. I did quite well in my GCSEs.
What were your subjects particularly?
My subjects really geography, history, music. Maths, English, did quite well. But French as well. Did pretty well in all of them, really. I even managed to get a B in home economics because I'm not a practical person at all. I couldn't do anything to do with woodwork, so I went and did cooking instead, which was fantastic. It was three of us lads sat at the back eating stuff out of the fridge and still managed to get a B. So it was good.
Can't be bad. So reasonably academic.
Reasonably academic, yes.
Any early thoughts about career?
Well, yes, actually. I'm very lucky in the fact that from about age 11, when I started secondary school, I wanted to be a journalist. What kind of sparked it was I used to read computer magazines. PC Format was the one which I used to read all the time. And I just always wanted my name in print. I wanted people to see my name there, maybe because I've got a slightly unusual surname, I don't know. But I just always really wanted to do it. And as a young teenager, I used to practice writing computer game reviews and things like that. You change your mind on and off, but I'm very lucky in that I have gone into a career that I have wanted to do since I was young. So it's really, really good.
So apart from seeing your name on the bottom of an article, what do you think it was that really appealed to you about journalism?
That was the main reason, I think, yeah. The vanity of that. But I think it's the thought that what you do remains there in history. I wanted to not leave a mark, that sounds a bit grandiose, but you know, you wanted to do something where you haven't just passed through time and been forgotten about. And with newspapers and magazines and things like that, is that records are kept in the National Records Office, and you know, the time team of 200 years' time may well be digging up articles with my name on it, which is a really nice thing to think about. And I think that's what always appealed to me. You know, you're doing that, albeit very, very small, but a very small bit of history, really. And I think that just always really fit. Plus, I'm nosy. And I think that really kind of works. I always want to know what's going on first. So journalism is definitely a good career if you're nosy.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yes.
Having decided that then at a fairly early age, that was good, I suppose, because you then knew exactly where you needed to go with it. But what did you need to achieve to get into journalism?
That was the problem. I didn't really know. The industry certainly wasn't that approachable at the time, so I didn't really know what to do. So I kind of hedged my bets, really, and just kind of kept my hand in doing a bit of writing. I was lucky enough to meet the then Shepton Mallet Journal reporter while I was at Whitstone School, who mentioned that they were looking for community correspondents at the time. So I thought, well, that's a good way to get into it. And I took that on, and it paid a barnstorming 5p a line, I think. though, to be fair, things haven't improved massively since the 90s. But she was, her name's Emma Frampton. She was very, very encouraging. I started writing for the newspapers I am now editor of at age 15. Which was just fantastic, and getting my name in print and getting the experience. And the great bit of advice she said to me is, look, keep what you wrote and look how it appeared in the paper and see what's changed. Because a lot of people write things, they see it in the paper and think, yeah, look, that lovely thing. But actually, the page designers, the sub-editors have tweaked it, have moved it around and sort of made it a bit more readable, really. And that was one of the best bits of advice I've ever had, because I, from an early age, I looked at what had been changed, and sometimes it was pretty much everything. But you could then ask why, or sometimes you could see why. You think, oh yeah, that's why. And that really did give me a good grounding, I think. And again, that gave me cuttings and it gave me experience, so that when I came to move into the job, people already knew my name, or I had things to show them.
And you were doing this while you were still at school?
Yes, still at school. It was very, very rare. Occasionally, once every 6 weeks, I'd do a story about something that happened in Binnigar, you know, a jumble sale with WI or something, you know, nothing groundbreaking. But it was just getting my hand in. And I had a few sort of page leads with my name on, which was great. And it didn't really detract from my studying because it was so infrequent, but it just proved, in hindsight, you realise how useful it was.
Yeah. But it came time eventually when you had to leave school and move on. Yeah. By that point, had you decided where you were going specifically with this, or was it still all a bit
vague? I was hoping to get into it, but I didn't really know how to go about it, really. So then I went on to Stroke College to do my A-levels, and one of those I chose was Communication Studies, which is the thing that I kind of picked to kind of get me into that industry. But I hedged my bets a bit with Geography and Business Studies A-levels as well, just to kind of give myself a broad range. And again, through doing my Communication Studies project, I was able to work with Emma Emma Frampton, and I produced a magazine, and with her advice she kind of wrote the report on it to say how good it was, what it or what needed improving, and that sort of thing, which was part of my project, which helped me get an A for that communication studies at A level, which again I think helped. And then I came out of A levels thinking, yeah, this is good, I've enjoyed this. And then she's like, right, where do you go from here? You know, we didn't have the internet for search for jobs or anything like that. You just think, what should I do? I went off and had job interviews in Bristol for various accountancy roles and office work, and I didn't get any of them.
Not really what I wanted to do.
So it was a blessing in disguise, really. But then I got the offer, and Emma again, she'd had a word with the assistant editor at those papers, Midsomerset Series Now, and you know they were looking for someone doing work experience, and she said, "Oh, I've got this guy I've spoken to. He's done work for me. He's a community correspondent. You know, should we get him in?" So I was asked to come in for a week's work experience, and I was scared, being a nervous teenager, and tried to get out of it, didn't know what to do. But my mum made me go in for one day, the Friday, and I ended up being there for 11 years. Not all as work experience, but it kind of led on from that. I didn't have a break then, effectively, in my service with those papers for 11 years. So it was fair play to... Well, thank you to Emma for getting me in there, and then my mum for forcing me to go in that day to do it.
You had an excursion somewhere in the middle to Portsmouth, didn't you?
That's right, yes. Once I'd done work experience, thankfully I proved myself as being a decent reporter, and a trainee reporter's job came up after a couple of months of work experience. So I applied for that and got that. And generally with journalism, even now, a lot of the training is done on the job. Some people are graduates, might get journalism degrees and then come into it, but predominantly we do our training on the job. And at that point I was, after I'd been there for a few months, I was sent off down to Portsmouth for three months to do my training, which was in shorthand. We still use shorthand now, no matter, you know, still stands up in court compared to a dictaphone. Did law, two law exams, did two public affairs exams, which is great because it gives you all the grounding that you need. And I went off and did that, and that was quite an eye-opening experience as well, as someone from rural Somerset going to Portsmouth for 3 months was quite something. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a great time, and we had a good crowd, and one of the people there was a dozen of us on that course, and one of them, Beth Rigby's now presenter on Sky News. So you know, we've all gone in different directions after it, but yeah, it was a really interesting time.
Okay, let's take your second track, shall we? Mm-hmm. Which is The Gravel Road by James Newton Howard.
Yes, now this is from the film The Village, and I've picked this one because this is the tune in which my wife walked down the aisle to on our wedding day, so always going to have very fond memories of this, so that's why I've chosen this.
Okay, here it is. Thank you. So that was The Gravel Road there by James Newton Howard, as chosen by Tim Letherby, who's the editor of the Western Gazette and many other things besides, which we'll come on and talk again about in a moment. So, Tim, you had a little excursion to Portsmouth, but you then ended up back in the Mid Somerset series. Mm-hmm. What were the early days of that like?
They were fantastic. It was
reporter.
I was, yes. I started off as a trainee reporter, and I did various roles within that. I was What's On editor. I took on the role of motoring correspondent, which was great because I meant I got to test drive different cars every week, which was always good. I'd go out and I'd cover council meetings and whatever stories that the news editor, assistant editor, wanted me to cover at the time. In those days, it was a case of, go on, Tim, go round the corner and go see what the fax machine's got churning out, right. Not email. These are pre-email days. That was fantastic. Once I'd got back from Portsmouth, and I did about a year of reporting, a position came up on the sub-editing side of things, which is the page design, the headline writing, putting the pictures on, cropping the photos. So I applied for that and got that, and then moved in a very sort of different direction, because that sort of planning, organised side of things suits me better than the running around being a reporter sort of thing, really.
People will have seen sub-editor as a title, but I doubt whether too many people know what a sub-editor actually does.
Yeah. I mean, basically, a sub-editor takes the stories. The stories are filed into our computer system by the reporters. Sub-editor takes those and places them on the page. So chooses the main story on the page, places it on there, writes the headline, puts the caption in, puts the photo in, and basically completes the page. So they're the person who builds that jigsaw, which from all the components from the photographers and the reporters.
Would it be right to say then the sub-editor more or less puts the paper together and the editor does an overview on it?
Absolutely,
it?
Yes. Yeah. The editor will be checking and working with the sub-editors to make sure everything's sort of in roughly the right place. But obviously, once you work on it, you know, sub-editor gets to know a good feeling of where the editor wants things placed. So
you became a sub-editor then?
Yes. So I did that, another sort of step up, and did that for a while, and then got the next step up to chief sub-editor, where you're in charge of the sub-editors, and then after a couple of years, next step up to assistant editor. This was all based in Wells for all the four Mid Somerset titles, which is the Wells Journal, Shepton Mallet Journal, Central Somerset Gazette, and Cheddar Valley Gazette. So I did that, and that took 11 years. That called sort of building up.
We're talking here of round about 2012,
2013. Yes, it was slightly earlier than that. Around about 2010, really. But at that point, we were owned by the Daily Mail, and they decided that the world doesn't need assistant editors. And there was a big cull, and we were all culled. All the assistant editors threw across the group, no matter how good or bad you were, didn't matter. If your job title was assistant editor, you went. So I was made redundant after 11 years, and went off and did a few other things. Did a bit of freelance PR. Did a bit of working for Motorsport News, which was fantastic because I love my motorsport. So I got to cover rallies and motor race events and things, and did all sorts of things. I mean, one day I was working on doing a preview for a computer game, and then a darts tournament, and then a gardening club. But I just couldn't make it pay ultimately. I'd love to have done. But that was around about the time when my wife and I got married as well. So it was a real period of change. But after a while, a job came up with the same company again, still owned by the Daily Mail, working in Bristol in a page design hub. At this point, they'd decided that the best way for sub-editors was to have them all sat in one office in Bristol, working on all the different newspapers. So I got a job in Bristol, and that was very, very different in the fact that because all the sub-editors had been removed from the local offices, there was a 40-strong team in Bristol, and we were just working our way through a list of stories, writing headlines. Someone was templating the pages, and we were just writing headlines. So within half an hour, I could be working on the Gloucester Citizen, the Western Daily Press, the Western Gazette, the Mid Somerset Series, all of those. It's not the right way to run newspapers, but there was 40 really good journalists there, and it was actually really good fun. And we had a good sort of camaraderie, and it was nice working in Bristol. The commute wasn't very nice, but actually working in Bristol was good. So that was kind of the next step.
Gave you some extra skills then.
Absolutely. And it was, really looking back in hindsight, I was very comfortable working just at the Mid Somerset Series. I'd done it since college. And, you know, actually being made redundant really shook me up and made me, you know, actually was a really good thing for me in the long run, because it made me challenge what I thought, you know, because I'd always just done things in one way. So, so yeah, it was a good thing ultimately.
Looking at your freelance time, you got involved with an election campaign somewhere in the middle.
I did, yes. At this point, I'd like to say that I am politically neutral.
Of course. We don't need to mention who.
No. But yes, there was a political candidate who approached me. Actually, that's not true. I touted myself out to all three main parties. I didn't care who I was going to work for. I was after work. But yeah, one of them came back and I worked with them, and they won the seat, which was a change in seat for the party, for one party changing to another for the first time in that constituency for 80 years. So it was quite a shift change. It potentially could have led to a career in political PR, but because it wasn't all paying quite enough, I'd already gone for the job in Bristol. Mm-hmm. By the time the election came, I kind of got that job about sort of a month before the 2012, I think, election. So
That must have been quite interesting doing that, because it's something totally different than you'd been.
It was fascinating, but also you realised from getting out and talking to people how people are fed up with politicians bickering about party politics. Mm. People, even back then, and it's even more so now, just want to know what they can do for them. You know, yes, their party politics gets things done in Parliament, and it really kind of shapes their way of dealing with situations. But what I did with this particular candidate is basically ignore the party politics. You know, yes, it was someone for a political party, but I just got this person out and about, meeting loads of different people, photo shoots in loads of different places, yeah. And it worked. Hopefully, that's and the way.
Said individual was elected. So yeah. That's the acid test, I suppose.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so you then came back into doing what you were doing in Bristol. You say that wasn't really the way you wanted to go. It wasn't really your thing, but it was useful experience.
Yes, yeah. It's you know, I'm very much for doing as much locally as you can. If you're going to do a proper local newspaper, you should have reporters on the ground. You should have your sub-editors on the ground. Now with economics, you know, it's not always possible, and you have to try and find the best compromise. So I think having all the paper designers in Bristol, it worked, but it's far better having them actually in the area they're covering, because you know, you want your page designer, when they're checking the copy over, to know how Nepnut Thrubwell is spelt, or can tell the difference between Mapperton with one P and Mapperton with two P's, and which one's in which county, and all of that sort of thing, and whether you pronounce it Crooken or Crooken. I've always been told Crooken, by the way, so people may shout at me for that, but I always call it Crooken. Maybe that's from being in Somerset, but it's not ideal, but we did have some really good journalists. We produced good papers, but it was just that lack of local knowledge. But things did change after about 18 months. The Daily Mail decided that it wasn't working, and they'd lost that local touch with their local newspapers. And I was called in by the boss at the time and said, "We're going to decentralise everything, send it all back out to the centres again." I said, "Oh, fantastic." He said, "Have you heard of the Mid-Somerset series?" I said, "Funnily enough, yes, I have." So I found myself back in the Wells office, back doing the chief sub-editor's role that I'd done 5 years previously, which was all very surreal, but better. So I was living in Wells, so it was worked really well again.
What happened next?
Next came the start of editorship, really. I did that again for another 18 months, and the role of editor for the Blackmore Vale magazine came up. And I was wanting, because I'd kind of gone back to a level below where I'd left Wells in the first time, I was thinking of how to progress my career. And this came up, and the offices are based in Stourbridge, just over the border into Dorset, of course. And I thought, well, that's not too far. And I knew the Blackmore Vale has such a really good reputation. So I applied for that and got the editorship there. It was in the early days of really pushing website growth. There was a new owner of all the titles as well, a company called Local World, who was seriously trying to push the website side of things while trying to keep the newspaper stuff going as well. So yes, I was brought in there. what's that name?
This is January 2014.
Yes, indeed. Crikey, yeah. I didn't think about it too much. But yeah, so I was brought in to grow the Blackmore Vale's website and to keep the magazine going strong. And I was there for 3 years working on the Blackmore
Vale. Tell me about Blackmore Vale, because it has, as you say, got a very good reputation around the locality.
But, absolutely.
It's different than a conventional newspaper. It's more of a magazine feel to it.
Yes, it is obviously a community magazine which says what's going on. Yeah. Rather than being a newspaper as such, it wasn't, still is, the Bible for people, picking it up and wanted to know all the different aspects of it. It was wonderful working on a title that's so well loved. You know, you often get used to working in newspapers, people shouting at you because they don't like the court stories and things like that. But because it was a different sort of title in the Blackmore Vale magazine, you were doing a lot less controversial stories. Yes, you're still doing issues that mattered, but it was great working on something where everybody was really on board, all the readers. I mean, it's free, so people don't pay for it. But huge circulation, covers such a wide area. But also, I was editor of the Stour and Avon magazine going down to East Dorset, was part of it as well. And the Matters, it was Sherborne Matters I introduced, and that was sat along Gillingham Matters and Shaftesbury Matters as well. So it was quite varied.
Okay, let's take your third track. Mm-hmm. This is the Shanking Song. Skanking Song.
Skanking Song.
Right.
Yes.
By Sponge?
Sponge, yes.
Sponge, right.
Yeah,
that's how I've never heard of this.
No, they're a kind of a West Country band, not massively well known, but they are one of the most fun bands you could possibly ever listen to. We always just put all their tracks on my iPod in the car when I'm going away on holiday, because all the kids, even the little ones, love them. It's just real good, feel good music. You can't not dance to it. Or skank to it in the case of this song, just absolutely love them. They're great fun, and we just love listening to Sponge. Okay. Makes you smile.
Here it is. Okay, that was the Skanking Song then from Sponge, as chosen by Tim Letherby, who's my guest on Folk Tales today. And Tim is the editor of the Western Gazette and many other titles besides. Tim, we got to the point where you were editor of the Blackmore Vale, and you stayed there, from January 2014 until late 2016, so more or less 3 years.
Yes, I was there for 3 years and saw quite a lot of change in that time. But after, and I was perfectly happy there, absolutely loved it there, really, really enjoyable. I was, to be honest, I was expecting to do most of my working, the rest of my working career there. But the editor of the Mid-Somerset series, coming back to them again, left. And because of my experience there, I was approached by our now owners, which was Trinity Mirror, to go up to there to be editor. They liked what I'd been doing with the Blackmore Vale magazine. They liked sort of the real community feel of it and how I'd kept that going. Yeah, they offered me the position of editor of the Mid-Somerset series and the Froome Standard and Somerset Guardian alongside that, which initially I was reluctant to do because you think never go back and all that sort of thing. And especially as I'd done it so many times already. But the lure of being editor of the newspaper I started on all those years previously was just too much, really. So I accepted. And I've now been in that role for almost 2 years. So
you were then officially editor of a newspaper as opposed to the Blackmore Vale, which is slightly different.
Yeah.
What were the challenges of that? I mean, this is the first time you'd been in overall control of a newspaper.
Yes, I mean, the biggest kind of change or challenge that I really had was suddenly thinking, now hang on, what you put on the front page and the reputation of the whole title matters because people pay for it. With the Blackmore Vale, people were in habit, people would pick it up, and you'd always put the strongest story on the front, but it was less important. Yes, you'd always pick up extra people picking it up if you had a certain story on the front page. But I now had to really get my head into what sells well, without selling yourself out, without going sensationalist, because sensationalist will always sell in the short term, but you can kill off your loyal readers, not literally, obviously, but these people who bought the paper for ages because they think it's gone, you know, the newspaper's not the sort of newspaper they want to buy anymore. So that was probably the biggest challenge. And I learned the hard way with a few things, thinking all this would make a good front page splash and it bombing completely. And then you think, all right, at least most of the time you could find out why. So I did a bit of experimenting in the early days, it was a real learning process to start with, but hopefully you've got the kind of knack of it now.
In that situation where you come in as the new editor,
mm-hmm.
and you've got a lot of experienced people that have been there for years, is there any element of they know better than you do about what their newspaper is about and what will sell?
Not really, mainly because at the time there was a huge shift change. The Wells office closed, people moved to here, into the Oval office. So to be honest, a lot of those people have been there for a long time left. It was a shame because we were really lacking their experience, but enabled me to stamp my authority on it in a certain way. Equally though, a lot of people I'd worked with previously and they'd worked with me when I was assistant editor for them, so they were used to the sort of thing. They knew what to expect from me as boss, effectively, and sort of newspaper. So there wasn't really any major issues.
Okay, so that role continues.
Yes,
but it's been augmented since then.
Yes, yeah. Well, what I've been trying to do is building up from the ethos of the Blackmore Vale into the Mid-Somerset series. So the Mid-Somerset series was caught between two stools before, and I'm not being critical of anybody, because it had to get website hits and sell newspapers. So it was a really difficult juggling act, and the audiences between print and online are very, very different. So when I was brought in to be editor of Mid-Somerset series, I was brought in to be editor of just the newspaper. So I don't have anything to do with the website side of things, and I haven't done from the start. So I could look after my print readers and do that. So what I've been trying to do is make it a lot more like the Blackmore Vale, a lot more community-minded, a lot more soft, a lot more friendly, a lot more supportive, pro-business, pro-community groups, charity fundraising, celebrate what's great about the area, because we do live in a wonderful area of the world. Why do it down? We still cover, you know, hold people to account, still cover court stories, but don't do it in a sensationalist way. And that has been working because people are getting, we're all bombarded by bad news all the time, but we're all getting the news, the really focused news, breaking news on our phones or our tablets or on 24-hour news on telly anyway. That's not what people are looking for to a weekly newspaper for anymore. What they want is a more rounded view of what is going on and more in-depth coverage. So we try to offer that as much as we possibly can. And that was working, is working at the Mid-Somerset series. Did a turnaround in the performance of the sales and commercially. So when the same thing was happening at the Western Gazette. So the former editor, Emma Slee, basically has gone to be purely editor of Somerset Live. I was asked to take on the print titles of the Western Gazette and to do the same thing. And initial signs are that it's working here as well. You know, the print industry, as I'm sure we're going to talk about, is going through an unprecedented era of change, but we're well above the national average in terms of performance. There's still a long way to go, but it's you know, I was asked to basically do the same thing.
You've been editor of the Western Gazette since May of this year, May 20th.
Officially, yes. Yeah, I'd actually been running it since early part of the year, but we had to, there was the reorganisation to do. So officially a few months now.
And you've tried to put in that change of emphasis, that softer touch during that period, haven't you?
Yes, definitely. I mean, in places like Yeovil, it's less important because Yeovil is still more a hard news sort of place and the readers want more hard news there. But for somewhere like Sherborne, definitely trying to make it a bit more grounded, a bit more, you know, an example I use is with my Shepton Mallet Journal hat on. There's a brewery, a wild beer company, who are building a new brewery on the Bath and West Showground. It's next to a special school. Now, in the past, 10, 20 years ago, the headline would have been shock as brewery moves in next to special school. What we're now doing is £10 million investment bringing 150 jobs. That's the different way of looking at it. It's the same story, but you know, people don't want that over-egged excitement, you know, now, not from their print newspaper. Because we all know in these days of health and safety and secure premises that there's absolutely no problem with a brewery being next to the special school there. Absolutely no problem. So why make it a problem? So we'd rather focus on the positive. And that's what I want people to kind of come to me with news stories, really, is we want to celebrate the positive. We want to celebrate Sherborne, we want to celebrate all of the towns and really promote what's going on here, because there is so much going on and so many interesting people and stories to tell. We don't need to focus on the negative.
In changing the direction of a well-established newspaper like the Western Gazette, you're taking a little bit of a risk. Mm-hmm. How calculated is that, and how do you tell whether it's working, and how quickly can you tell that?
Yeah, it was... quite a calculated risk in a way, because the Western Gazette was doing quite well. You know, there wasn't a massive need for change. Emma moved across because they wanted her focus on Somerset Live, not because she was doing anything wrong. Yeah. Because we're part of a national company, we were able to look at various bits of market research and get feedback from people. And if when you get that clear a message coming from your readers saying, we want more local news, we want more positive news, you know, you have to go down that route. So yes, it was a risk in a way because things weren't broke, but things have improved. So it has worked, but it was backed up with science, really.
How do you know it's worked? Is that in terms of circulation figures?
Yes, circulation figures, definitely. We're performing well above the national average. No newspaper can claim they're selling more newspapers than 5 years ago. We've got to be realistic. There's so many more drains on people's attention span and time. But when you look at the figures and you look at the analytics, people are reading their newspaper for just as long as they ever have done. So those who are buying the newspaper are still sitting down and reading it. You know, you've got that real engagement with them. The way I see that it is working as well is that sort of we're getting lots of letters in and that shows a bit of engagement and the way that people are talking about things. With all the sort of analytics that you have from Facebook and Twitter and Google, you end up in these echo chambers where everybody says the same thing and you all end up agreeing with each other, but you're not getting any counter views. That's what I think the role of a newspaper is incredibly important. I think that shows the success of it as well, is that people with opposing views are writing letters on the letters pages and arguing, because we are actually provoking debate, which is healthy for everybody, I think.
Editorial independence is something which is very important within mm-hmm. the media, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Can you make those type of changes without any interference from above?
Yes, I can. We're very lucky. There's advantages and disadvantages of being owned by a big national company. Of course there are, but I am generally completely left to my own devices in terms of the editorial direction. We are completely neutral of political party. We are neutral when it comes to other controversial subjects like fox hunting or green versus nuclear energy or badger coals, which are the things that really get people, you know, we are neutral. We'll give both sides a say and, you know, people can decide. I don't have any dictation from higher up. Above me is an editor-in-chief for the entire region who steers overall kind of, you know, looks at costs and looks at the overall editorial direction, but generally leaves me to it. And certainly from higher up, if you think that the Mirror newspaper is, you know, ultimately owns us, we are not under any influence to follow their political persuasions, or obviously the right-wing newspapers, or more right-leaning, should I say, newspapers that they've recently bought. What people don't necessarily understand is, for them now, it's all about audience. Diversity of audience and the amount of audience, which is why you have a left-leaning and a right-wing national newspaper owned by the same company. The management structure do not have a political leaning. They just want to reach as many people as possible. And by having two adverse political sides, you're getting to two different sides again. So it was quite a shrewd move, really. But there's no dictation coming down from them to me. I've just got to really do what's right for my local readers.
That's good.
Definitely.
Let's take your fourth track and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about maybe the future of local newspapers. This is Mariachi El Bronx. Have I got that right?
You have indeed, yes. The name of the band and the name of the song. They are a heavy metal, thrash metal band who every other album do a mariachi album, which is just bizarre, but wonderful. So you get a heavy metal album, which they don't title. You just got Bronx 1, 2, 3 and 4. And now they in between, they do their mariachi Mexican guitar trumpet stuff. 1, 2, 3 and, well, 1, 2 and 3 now. Again, it's really great fun stuff. It's fantastic hearing this heavy metal band doing mariachi music. They're very, very good at it. It's just really, really, really good music.
That was Mariachi El Bronx, as chosen by Tim Letherby, my guest on Folk Tales today. Tim, we've talked about your journey through the various newspapers you've worked for, and the Blackmore Vale magazine, and you still are editor of the Western Gazette and the other Mid Somerset series. Just tell me about the role of local newspapers now, because there's all sorts of alternative things that we've alluded to, ways of getting your news.
Yeah.
What do you see as the changing role of the local newspaper?
Well, I think that firstly, the role of a local weekly newspaper is really important. We've got to make sure that we are giving everybody as much information as they can get, and let them decide on all of the various different factors that are coming in. So we're this hub at the centre. We get the news in and we distribute it to thousands and thousands of people. That role is becoming increasingly important with the advent of social media and online. There is definitely, you know, this big growing online audience, and it's incredibly important. The dangers of social media and getting your news online is that most people have an agenda. So if something is shared, it will be shared for a reason, or people can come out and openly criticise. And where, you know, I welcome anybody phoning me up or emailing me with a criticism of the newspaper if it's fair and balanced. Very often it isn't. It's done with an agenda, but you don't know what that agenda is. And there's also the issue of paying to promote things online as well. All of these things mean that what people see and the news they read, A, it can be good that it's tailored to them, but B, it can also be unduly influenced, which is what obviously you've seen with the allegations about Russia and things like that. It does happen on a massive, massive scale, and it's happening more, which means that independence of newspapers is more and more important, because we don't have an agenda. Our agenda is to promote things in a positive way, as I've said. So the other side of things is that we aim to give as much information as we can do, because again, people are becoming more inward looking, and are missing out on things for, you know, as well with like Facebook and people like this. People don't necessarily realise that they are a big money making business. That is what they're there for. They've done a fantastic PR effort and making it seem like they're there for to benefit the community, but they're not. They are, and we find that a lot of our main rival is now Facebook. You know, you don't see a lot of the news that you see in our papers online because it doesn't drive the right numbers to make it worthwhile for the website to do. So probably 80% of what you see in the paper, you don't get on Somerset Live, for example, or any other news website. But people are sharing events and things on Facebook, but not realising that just because they share it in a group with 4,000 people, it won't be seen by those 4,000 people unless they pay for it. And once you pay for it, to start with, it's very, very cheap. And this is the real challenge for us, is that people are paying, you know, £3.50 for so many thousand hits, great. But by the time you actually reach the genuine audience that you get from the newspaper, you've paid more than if you just paid for an advert in the newspaper in the first place. But equally, if it's any community event, we don't make you pay for it anyway. We'll happily do a story about any community event that's coming up. You know, if it's a big posh do where tickets are £30 a piece, well then, you know, yes, we'd hope that there would be some advertising with that. But if it's for a charitable cause or a smaller sort of event or something like that, you know, we would run anyway and we wouldn't make people pay for it. So it's important for us, for local newspapers, to be that independent source of news where people know that they can trust it. They can know that there's been no undue influence there, because I can genuinely say, hand on heart, there is no agenda. And, you know, that's in places where they've lost their local newspaper. You know, people are now relying on Facebook groups to get their news, but A, they're seeing the news that Facebook wants them to see, or that people have paid for Facebook to tell them to see, and that's not giving people choice. You know, if it's a newspaper, you can choose what you want to read. So I think it's really, really important that we're giving people that access to their local news, really.
You alluded a while back to the fact that no local newspaper's circulation figures will be anything like they used to be 10 years ago, for example. So that you do face challenges in the viability of the newspaper going forward, I imagine. How do you deal with that? I mean, you put your price up, 10% price increase not that long ago.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, 10p.
Yes. But equally, that must have an effect on your ability to attract advertisers as well. How does it all, what's the viability?
It's what we have to do, you know, basically our money is made 95% from advertising. The cover price increase was to cover rise in transport costs, rise in petrol, basically, for people delivering the newspapers. So that's where that came from. Yes, it is more challenging if you're not selling quite so many newspapers to get advertising in. However, the way we're combating that is there's two ways of doing it. Firstly is to provide people with advertising solutions. So we go to people rather than say, do you want to put an advert in the paper? We say, who do you want to reach? If you want to reach your typical print reader, then we sort out a print advertising campaign. But if they're wanting to reach perhaps slightly younger, more transient audience, or your commuters, not the people who are bought into their community, then it's online. So we give them the solution. It's all part of the same business. So, you know, we don't feel like we're robbing each other. We're not in competition with each other. But also, you know, we can provide figures showing that, you know, the engagement of people in the newspaper, because they are paying for it, is far higher than other types of advertising, because, well, A, the sort of people who buy newspapers are likely to be slightly more affluent and have more disposable income to spend with the advertisers, but also because they spend so long reading the paper that they see the adverts for longer, and therefore it's likely to attract their attention for a lot more. So, you know, it's...
It's a very distinct market from the online business.
Yes, it's very, very distinct. You know, what people want, I've explained what we want in print, but online it's a lot more, they obviously want immediate things now, so car crashes, travel, traffic, weather, you know, celebrity, that sort of thing. I mean, on Somerset Live, for example, the biggest hitter is always, why am I stuck in traffic on the M5? Yeah. No, that is completely irrelevant to all of my print titles, but that whenever there's a crash on the M5, that is huge for them because people are stuck on there Googling it on their phones. Yeah. That is that audience. Yeah. That is not my print readership. Yeah. So it's really good that we can split it apart and do each of our separate bits properly rather than trying to juggle the two.
Tim, time is catching up on us, but just tell us before we close a little bit about the mechanics of putting a newspaper together on a weekly basis. I'm imagining there's a bit of a scramble towards a print deadline, is there?
Yes, we go to press at 10:45 on a Wednesday morning, but we start the next paper immediately afterwards. We have the reporters gathering the news from then on, filing it into the system, and the sub-editor is just working their way through the pages, placing things. Obviously, we kind of build up from the back, so you get the more important news towards the front. And then normally about Tuesday afternoon, we have an idea of what we're going to run as the front page splash and the front page story. So at that point, I'm in conversation with my sub-editors and make sure we agree and we go with that, and then we sort of finish the pages off, do the front pages on a Wednesday morning. But it's constantly on the go. There's always stories going in. There's always stories we can't fit in because we always have more stories than we have space for. But we can always roll those over to the next week if they're not dateable events. And that gives us the stuff to start going again for the next week. So
how many people are working directly on the Western Gazette?
Not very many. I've got a very small team of reporters. I've got one staff reporter, three freelance reporters, and a page designer and a sports editor, and that's it. But all the Somerset Live reporters, so we have a Somerset Live reporter for the whole of South Somerset and North Dorset, and also one for Yeovil. While they do not directly work for me, they cover the bigger stories for the area, so we use their copies. So you kind of include them as well, really. So it's all part of a bigger team, and we all kind of overlap slightly.
And you've got slightly different editions, obviously, for different parts of the area. Is that complicated to put that together, or do you just allocate them two or three pages, or whatever it is?
It's the first five pages are different for all of the five editions. So in your Sherborne edition, your first five pages will be Sherborne or West Dorset news. In Yeovil, that'll be Yeovil. Then we've got a Crookhanchard and Ilminster edition, Sumpton and Langport edition, and a Wincanton, Castle Kerry, Bruton and Gillingham edition. So the first five pages are completely unique for those, but then the rest of it is stuff that's of wider interest, or that if you've got too much for one edition, we kind of put that in, goes in all the editions, and it's kind of a bit of a juggling act to make sure it's not too dominant for one place, really.
Okay. I imagine the role of editor is a fairly full-on one, particularly around the print deadline time, but how do you relax at home?
How do I relax? I play Skittles. That's always good. The sport of kings. So that's kind of like my main sort of hobby, really. But I've got four kids. A lot of people say, is it stressful being an editor? I say you should have four children. but yeah, obviously doing family things is great.
So, you mentioned motorsport as well.
Yes, yeah. Recently went to up into Wales a couple of weekends ago for the Wales Rally GB with my dad and slept in the car and went into the Welsh Forest, which was absolutely fantastic. So try and get to that. Well, we've done that every year since 1996 now without fail. So that's good. But otherwise, it's just kind of being dad taxi, really, and but it's great. Love it.
Tim, thank you for being with us. We're going to play out with your final track, A Ghost in the Arcade by Idlewild.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I just chose this one, really, because you say building up to the stresses of deadline. This is often a song that goes through my head. It's a real kind of get-you-going tune, and back in the days when I was single, we used to play songs like this to kind of get you ready for before the date and or before you go and play Skittles or something like that. It's kind of a real kind of just kind of get-up-and-go kind of song. So it's really catchy. So, yeah, really love it.
Tim, thank you very much.
My pleasure. What is your